Hawkeye, could I ask you to get me a glass of water, please? I'd like to have you open your Bibles, please, to Ezekiel chapter 16. We're going to go to Genesis chapter 18 and 19 today and look at a few things. As Hawkeye is bringing me a glass of water, I will let you know a little personal information about our family, our Hawkeye and Zachary's cross-country team. We were pleasantly surprised this week to see in the paper, and it was on the internet also, that their cross-country team was rated number one in state, so they're 4A number one team right now. We figured that would last through Thursday night at our first meet, where they would probably not do so well and we would lose our rating, so we made a bunch of copies of it and told as many people as we could that we're rated number one in state, because we knew we just had a few hours to enjoy that rating. But then they won the meet, finishing 3 in the top 5. Hawkeye was rated 11th in the state for overall runners. So they ran pretty good, and again, had 3 in the top 5. They won the meet. Zach ran a good time. He got second in the fresh soft race. Is that correct, Zach? Valley finished 1-2 in the freshman race. They won the, looks like we've got 3 people getting me a glass of water right now. Does anyone else want to go out and help get the water for me? Could just take a 5-minute break here. I could just walk back and get a drink. It'd be quicker. Watch, I'm going to complain so I wanted something else. Ladies and gentlemen, the 11th rated runner in the state running for the number one team. Here he is. It's cold. Wow, thanks. I just wanted a glass of water. Yeah, so it took so long. It's got my picture on it. Thank you very much. Sorry. Okay, we're going to talk today about Sodom and Gomorrah. A lot of things come up in that. We're going to skip a couple of verses. I'll have you read them when we get there, so we don't have to actually read them out loud, you know, Sunday morning and all. Several things we're going to see. One, the main issue is going to be the character trait of the society of Sodom and Gomorrah. There is corruption in there, but it's more than what just comes out in the story, in the sense of that's always focused on. It is a decline in culture. In fact, look in chapter 16 of Ezekiel, verse 49 and 50. And this is an important verse because I don't want to lose track of what's going on in this story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Chapter 16 of Ezekiel, verse 49 and 50. The scriptures record this. Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. This is now Ezekiel speaking to Jerusalem. It says your sister, is referring to a city. You know, Jerusalem was a city, and a sister city was Sodom, or Sodom and Gomorrah. And this was their sin. She and her daughters, that would be the cities surrounding Sodom, Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboiim, we're going to read about some of those today. She and her daughters were, here's the list of sins now. They were arrogant. They were overfed. They were unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things. Now, so often what comes out in their story, we don't want to shy away from it, is the detestable things that they were doing. We're going to see in the story. But that is the surface, if you understand what I'm saying. What we're going to see in the story, what's always brought out in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, is the detestable attitudes they had towards sexuality. True, indeed a sin. We could go to Romans and read about that in just a moment. But look at this again. This was their sin. This was where it all came from. They were arrogant, meaning they put their thoughts and their ways, no one could correct them. They had their own decisions that they made. Overfed. That means, again, when Lot left Abram, he went down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, which was like the garden of God. It was plentiful. There was so much there. It was filled with luxury. You'd drop a seed in the ground, it would grow. The workload was minimal. They were overfed. Unconcerned. Well, now, we talked about this on Wednesday night. When we have, it talks about James address the rich and the wealthy of in James chapter 5. the rich and wealthy, their problem in the book of James was that they weren't concerned with anybody else. They hoarded their wealth. They did not spread it out and use it for helping other people. Now, we're not talking about socialism, but we're talking about those that have money and have an abundance have a responsibility to assist those who are struggling. Not give them a free ride, give them a free lunch, but to be concerned about those who are struggling. It's part of from the book of Leviticus, all the way through the Bible, the rich need to be helping others. That's what we are. The wise need to be giving wisdom. Those that have resources need to spread them out. Whatever you've got, you should be contributing it. That's part of the human nature, human society. The city of Sodom and Gomorrah, unconcerned. They had many advantages, but those advantages were always turned back towards themselves. They did not help the poor and needy, similar to what we just got in saying. They were haughty, now again, referring to pride, thinking themselves better. And obviously then, one of the last things they did was they did detestable things, things that would serve or please themselves with no regard to others. In our story, we're going to see the two angels that have just been treated very hospitable by Abraham. He rushed out to meet them. He begged them to stay. They agreed. He went and prepared a fantastic meal for them and then didn't sit down and eat with them, but stood and served them while they ate. And then when they get up to leave, he escorts them a certain distance, maybe as much as 3 miles away as they look down on Sodom and Gomorrah. He escorted them, finishing the job of a perfect host. The city of Sodom and Gomorrah are not going to be even close to being a good host to the angels when they arrive. And so again, that is the sin of Sodom as we look at this right here very quickly. Let's go, while we're doing this, let's go to Romans chapter 1. Just look at this very quickly. Because sexual sin is going to come up here in this chapter, chapter 19. And again, it becomes the focus, and it definitely has its place. It's a lot of people try and read it away as they try and explain, different things. It's clearly there. It's clearly a sin. But the sin that we read in chapter 19 of Sodom and Gomorrah, or that wasn't even just touched on in those verses there in Ezekiel, the sin of homosexuality that is addressed in Sodom and Gomorrah, or the account of Genesis 19, is the result of a bigger problem. It's not like, that was the sin. No, the sin was deep. The sin was in their character, in their arrogance, in their selfishness, in their being overfed, not being concerned about other people. Obviously, then, of course, this sprang up. Look at Romans chapter 1. A set of familiar verses, and it's going to come up in these ways, verses also. But these despicable sins, these deviant ways, are not the root of the problem. They're the symptom of the problem. And I guess what I'm trying to say is when they begin to surface in an individual life, or they begin to surface in a culture or society, it's too late almost. We've gone a long ways down the trail. And when a society accepts it, as we're going to see in this chapter, it's not like, now they're starting to sin. No, they've been sinning for so long that this is the fruit of their sin. Here we go. Look in chapter 1 of Romans, verse 21. It says, "For although they knew God," so God has revealed himself to all people. That's what this is talking about. "They knew God," God's general revelation. "They neither glorified him as God or gave thanks to him." So concerning the revelation of God, not the scriptural revelation, but just the general presence of God as being creator, they reject that. God made it obvious, they reject it. There's the beginning of the problem. "For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened." You reject the concept of a God, an absolute creator, a judge, your hearts are darkened. You have no understanding. "Although they claim to be wise," so in that state now, they've rejected truth, they've suppressed the truth, and they've developed their own truth as, we're wise in our own truth. This is what we believe to be true. Thinking to be wise, although they claim to be wise, they became fools. Compared to reality, they're fools, but no one knows it. "They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. therefore, because they've embraced this false truth, their own reality, and called themselves wise, God does this. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity. God says, fine, live there. Live in your false reality. Live in what you call wisdom. And guess what you're going to find? You're going to find the sin nature. You're going to find all kinds of corruption in your own nature. In the sinful desires of their hearts, the sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Because of this, God says, well, go further. Go a little further down the line. Because of this, God gave them over to their shameful lust. And he goes on, you can read that next verse right there. I'm not going to read all the details here. I mean, I want to, but I'm not going to because it's Sunday morning. And it can read that. And right there, what you've got right there is a corruption of sexuality, a depreciation of the whole concept. Sexuality, an individual who a person is, needs to be honored. It needs to be recognized as sacred. And once it's thrown off, once you throw off, for example, the concept of homosexuality being compared to the races of people. You know, we want equal rights for the races of people. All different types of nationalities deserve equal rights. And the reason we believe that, the reason I believe that, is because that is something God created. That is something that God has made sacred. God has made, if it be the black, the white, the Chinese, the Asian, whatever, he's made the different cultures of people, different races of people. We've studied that in Genesis. And they're to be honored and recognized and kept sacred. God has also created, guess what? Men and women, or male and female. Those are also sacred. Do you understand what I'm saying? So different races of people are designed by God, and sexuality, male and female, is designed by God. And what happens sometimes is people who want to depreciate sexuality will compare it to nationality or races and say, well, just like the races need to be kept separate and we need to recognize them in freedom for all, we also want freedom for, well, for example, homosexuality. It's like you can't do that because homosexuality is a corruption of another institution or another sacred thing that God has established, which is sexuality. In other words, the two are not compatible. You can't say homosexuality is similar to the races and they all deserve equal rights. No. Homosexuality is the perversion of male and female that God has established. And to say that, you're going two different directions with it. And of course, it's illogical. Of course, it comes against the scriptures. But of course, thinking to be wise, they become fools. I'll say it one more time. Races are sacred because God has established it that way. Sexuality, male and female, is sacred because God has established it that way. The Bible, is consistent. It's wisdom. It makes sense. But when you corrupt it, and you've got over here, well, we're going to honor the races, but we're also going to honor homosexuality, you've now are thinking illogical and you are entered into the realm of a fool, but you think you're wise and we're to shudder at your intelligence, which is really foolishness. And so I mock that today. Let's go to Genesis chapter 18. As we see in this story now, a great cry, as we left off last week, has come up to God in heaven. He's heard an outcry. He's heard these complaints. We went through several things last week, and we saw last week several places where when an outcry reaches God, it is of violence in the society. It is those who are being oppressed in the society that are crying out. Those who are suffering because of the society are crying out to God for help. And thus, an outcry has reached heaven, has reached God, meaning something's going on in this city where there is oppression and people are crying out for help. Let's begin in chapter 18, verse 20. Then the Lord said, speaking to Abraham, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sins so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. Now understand, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah that God has heard is not simply the cry of homosexuality. Okay? I mean, it's going to come out here in the story. The cry of homosexuality, or if there's a complaint against homosexuality, it goes a lot deeper than that. Again, the homosexual problem that they've got in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah is a symptom of a greater problem that has been going on for years. And so the outcry may include that, but it is a lot more severe than that. I guess the point there is whenever you start seeing this start popping up in a society, there is a much deeper problem. Whenever you have people starting to accept and say this is normal, you've got a very serious problem. You're out of touch as a culture with reality. You're out of touch as a culture with what is sacred and what is instituted by God. You are destroying your culture, or you have begun to destroy your culture, and you don't even know it. Sodom and Gomorrah had no clue how far they had gone. Thinking they were wise, they had become fools. A culture that has no trouble, I don't see any problem with this. Oh, my goodness. You don't see a problem with the corruption of the natural order? You don't see the problem with this? If you have no problem with that, I'm sorry. You are a fool, but you're going to come back at me and say, no, we're so wise. Well, here we go. In this case, the outcry has come up. I'm going to go see how bad it is. Verse 23, the men, which we know to be angels, turned away and went towards Sodom. And Abraham remained standing before the Lord. The word standing is a word that is translated in different places in the Septuagint and in the Greek language that is used to translate the Hebrew in the New Testament, is used of standing before a tribunal, standing before a judicial decision, standing before the court with the judgment on the seat, saying, I know you've made your judgment, but I would like to appeal this, or I'd like to speak this. In other words, he's standing before the Lord for judgment. Not so much judgment for himself, but to hear the Lord's decision. And as he's standing before the Lord, again, that's all built on the phrase, Abraham remained standing before the Lord. And he's going to refer to him as the judge of all the world here in just a few verses. So Abraham has heard this. He says, I'm going to go down to see how bad it is. And Abraham is standing now before the tribunal, before the bench for the decision. Then Abraham approached him. Makes sense. Approached the bench. Approached him, not waiting for the decision, but notice this. Notice the graciousness of God. Notice the openness, and you're going to see this throughout the story. God has a plan. God is the judge. God is sovereign. But for some reason, he has designed it. He has desired that he has made man in his own image. And in this case right here, Abraham has the opportunity to approach the judge of all the world, who is about to pronounce judgment, and says, just a minute. I have a request I would like to make. And the judge doesn't zap him with lightning, listens to him like a friend. This dialogue that we're going to hear, you indeed have the judge of all the world, and you have a mere man made of dust and ashes, but yet their relationship is in a friendly way. God has given permission to this man of dust and ashes to speak to him as a friend, and God listens and negotiates and gives him what he wants, which opens the whole realm up, or the whole area up, of prayer. You realize Christians don't pray like many other religions pray. Christians don't pray like the religions of the world. We don't stand before some kind of a deity and try and appease him and throw him offerings and try and do appease him somehow with our actions. We come to him and talk. We share our thoughts. We share our desires. And he responds to us. That's what prayer is. Jesus says, teach us how to pray. Jesus was praying to the Father in such a way that they said, teach us how you pray. How do you do this? He began like this. He says, say, our Father, who art in heaven, our Father. He didn't say, oh God, sovereign Lord of all, judge of all mankind, although that's true. He says, if you want to pray like I pray, you go to him like a father. Father. And the word is, in a sense, it's Abba, or it refers to a close relationship. Still not the father of, he's my dad, and he's the head of the house, and I'm terrified of him. But father, as in a close relationship, like you're sitting across from the supper table, or you're talking about something in the car, you're in a relationship. Say, our Father, who art in heaven. Of course, then he says, hallowed be your name, indicating we still recognize you not as some just one of us, just one of us guys. No, you are a Father who we have a relationship with, but you are still the holy God. You are still the judge of all mankind. Nonetheless, Abraham approaches him and says, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do what's right? Now listen, Abraham doesn't say, well, we'll have to wait and see. Maybe it's not as bad. Maybe they'll come back and say it's not that bad. Let's just wait and see. When the angels leave to go find out how bad it is, what is Abraham's response? Oh, man, this is not good. Because guess what? Abraham knows how bad it is, right? He's okay. He says, but in that city, if there are 50 people there that are righteous, he says, you can't destroy the whole city for 50 people. We've got to do something with those 50. It wouldn't be right. God's mad at the city. The city's wicked. But if there's 50 righteous people, we've got to do something. He says, you would not. It's not in your character. I'm just wipe out the 50 righteous people too. He says, you do make a distinction between the wicked and the righteous. What will you do if there's 50 righteous people? God's response, verse 26. If I find 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, watch this. I will spare the whole place for their sake. You know what I would say? If there's 50 righteous people, I'll get them in one area, I'll destroy the rest of the place, and let the 50 people live. God doesn't do that. He says, notice what he says. He says, if there's 50 righteous people, I'll spare the entire place. If 50 righteous people will deliver the entire city. Understand this. How important it is for the church of Jesus Christ at this time in history, no matter what culture you're in, no matter what nation you're in, to be the righteous. So that when God looks down, he can at least see within any of a culture, no matter where they're going, how far they're running off the edge of reality, within that culture is these 50 righteous people. God doesn't say, well, I will spare the righteous people. He says, I will spare the entire city for the righteous people. And there's several ways of looking at that. One of the reasons being what? If there are 50 righteous people in that city, there's hope that that city could be converted. There's hope that that city could be influenced. Abraham has been a huge influence on this Canaanite culture. He's bringing people to the Lord. He's got friends that are in covenant with him. He's going to train up his children. He's going to produce nations that are going to be known as righteous nations. 50 righteous people. Not only is God going to, he's not just going to spare it because, well, okay, that's good enough. I don't want to hurt the 50 righteous people. If there's 50 righteous people, there's hope for the nation. In other words, there's hope for America if the church is following God. There's hope for America if the church realizes who Jesus Christ is, what the Word of God says, that we can bring this truth into our world and make this truth line up with our world's truth. We can see a difference. We can make a difference. Okay, well, he goes on. Then Abraham spoke up again. Now that I've been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ash. Now realize again, he's standing before the tribunal. He's standing before the judgment seat, but yet he's talking to the judge like a father. You understand what I'm saying? There's this tension here of, you know, I shouldn't be even saying anything, but, you know, we've got a covenant, so I'm going to talk to you like a father, if you wouldn't mind seeing it that way. Now that I have been so bold to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ashes, what if the number of the righteous is 5 less than 50? I like his logic here. Will you destroy the whole city because of 5 people? In other words, for 50 people, God will spare the city. So now it's down 50. Okay, and we've got that locked in. That's a word of God. That's his promise. For 50 righteous people, I will not destroy the city. Abraham says, well, What if there's 45? 45. Would you destroy it for 45? And if you would, that means you destroyed it because of five people. Five people turned away from God. Five people became wicked, and you destroyed the whole city. Would you really destroy an entire city because five people turned away? Well, you understand the logic there. If I find 45 there, he says, I will not destroy it. Once again, he spoke to him. What if only 40 are found there? He drops another five. What about 40? For the sake of 40, I will not do it. Then he says, may the Lord not be angry, but let me speak. Now he's gone down from 50 to 45, 45 to 40. He's dropping five at a time. Now he takes a little bit more of a lunge. What if only 30 can be found? He answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. Now I want you to notice he's not moving the 30 out, but he's delivering the entire city because of those 30. Abraham says, now that I have been so bold as to speak to the Lord, what if only 20 can be found there? He says, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. Then he says, may the Lord not be angry, but let me speak just one more time or once more. What if only 10 can be found there? He answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. When the Lord had finished speaking with Abraham, he left, and Abraham returned home. So right here, Abraham returns back. He's been the perfect host, escorting the Lord. And now, what we have here is the Abraham not petitioning for himself, not petitioning for his family or the people of God, the nation of Israel, but actually petitioning for Gentiles, or in this case, wicked unbelievers. And he's petitioning, saying, what about this? Is there something we can do? You see a great example of, in a sense, Abraham beginning to be a blessing to the other nations as he's interceding or praying. Why did he stop at 10? Maybe he was confident that there's several answers to that. And again, one of them is right, and the others are just guesses. And I'm not sure which one would be. One is if he had 10, that was, he'd gone from 50 to 10, he could have took them all the way down to 1, and God would have said, okay, for the sake of 1, I will not destroy the city. That could be. Not sure if that's the right answer or not. Or 10, why 10? Well, that's, you get under 10, you really don't have a social group any longer. You've got some individuals. If you've got 50, 40, 30, 20, 10 people, you've got a cultural group. You've got, in a sense, an assembly, a congregation. We'd call it a church. There now there's 10, they can make a difference. If you get under 10, you don't really have a group. You've got like a couple people, and you better get out of the city. 10, maybe because in his mind, maybe he had 10 people he identified. Okay, Lot's two daughters, Lot's wife, the son-in-laws, that's six, and maybe a couple other people could have been amazing. There's 10. I know 10 righteous people in there. And maybe he got down that number, so once he got to 10, okay, good, well, the city's safe because I know there's 10 righteous people there. Whatever the answer, he stopped at 10. And the Lord then leaves, apparently goes back into heaven. The angels have been sent on assignment. The angels have been sent. Abraham, or the Lord appears to have come to talk with Abraham to bring him the good news. The angels came along to continue their journey to bring the bad news or the judgment on Sodom. And again, we see throughout Scripture angels bringing deliverance and angels bringing judgment. And it's referred to several times. Chapter 19, verse 1, if you're saying, well, how do you know these are angels? Well, here we go. Chapter 19, verse 1, finally, the two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. Now, sitting in the gateway of the city, that indicates that's the place of where the courts would meet. That's where the judges sat. Everything came into the city gate. Everything, they had walls around the city, and if you came into the city, you had to come through the gate. So if you wanted to be somewhere, this is where you'd want to be. This is where the action took place. Anybody that came in, came through. Anybody important came through this gate. Anyone with merchandise came through this gate. The finances, the economy came through this gate. Everything, the enemies would attack at the gate. Everything happened at the gate. Now, when we were in Israel, we went to several places, including Hazar and Gezer. And we saw what they called six-chamber gates, where they would have built by Solomon, recorded in the scripture that Solomon built them. But they'd have six, they'd have three chambers on this side, or rooms, if you would, on this side, three on this side, and they'd be tall towers-like, and then you'd have the walkway, the road coming through there. And in these chambers, or in these gates, is where the judges would sit. We could see at Gezer, we could actually still see the benches, again, stone remains of where the judges would have sat. Now, I went down and sat in one of the benches and had some pictures taken of me as sitting in the gates of judgment in Gezer. Of course I did. But anyway, this is where he's sitting there. They're not just sitting there, you know, like outside the barber shop talking. This is where this was the control center of the city. Okay, I know, the barber shop is the control center of the city many times also. But nonetheless, that he's sitting gate, meaning he has risen to a place of some kind of leadership in the city, otherwise he wouldn't be sitting there. And also notice, he would not be sitting there by himself. He would be sitting there with other leaders of the city, which is important because he is the only one to respond to these two strangers, these two foreigners, these two aliens that have come into the city that need hospitality. And to understand this chapter, and again, listen, this is because there's some tough things coming in this chapter, but to understand what's going on in chapter 18 and 19, I believe, and you can make your own decision, the author is, as he's writing this, under the inspiration of God, is showing a contrast between Abraham and Lot, and the issue is something that is very important to these people of this time in this culture, and that is the issue of hospitality. Meaning, do you have in yourself the compassion, the love, the civic duty of reaching out and being hospitable? Do you have within yourself the resources to be able to be hospitable? Do you have within your own ability the forces to protect someone? When the two angels and the Lord came to Abraham's house, they weren't threatened. They were given gifts. They were given a great meal. They were protected. They were served. They were escorted out. They were well taken care of, which is a sign. It was a great honor. The reason Abram is a great man is because he had the ability and the integrity to be a good host. Now, the contrast comes in chapter 19. And as you know the story, it is going to be everything but good hospitality in Sodom. Abraham is going to be blessed because he is a good host. Sodom is going to be destroyed because they cannot and do not want to be a good host. Again, in our idea, a host is you come over to my house, I serve you cake and ice cream, and you know, have a little conversation, you leave. You know, that's hospitality. In this, hospitality extended to a larger area: protection, provision, kindness, setting aside your own desires to serve the guest. And again, let's read this now. Chapter 19, verse 1. The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. My lords, okay, he greets them, he gets down, he bows down, he doesn't worship them. That's not worship, it's a sign of respect. My lords, he said, please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet, spend the night, and then go on your way early in the morning. He's trying to reduplicate Uncle Abraham. This is what he lived with Abraham. He grew up with Abraham. He's got the same style that Abraham's got. Now realize, we will make fun of Lot. We'll think of him as being wicked. He's an example of someone who's been absorbed into his culture. But yet the Bible, including the New Testament, calls him righteous. Righteous. Lot is a righteous man. Now again, he's not as on a scale of comparing or compared to Abraham. Abraham is a lot more righteous than Lot. But Lot is a righteous beacon in this city. Of course, it's all relative to who you're comparing it to. So compared to Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot is righteous, and there's several things he's going to do in this story that are ridiculous, including living in Sodom. But there are several things in this story that indicate he is a righteous man. One, he's trying to be hospitable. Two, he's trying to take care, he'll end up trying to take care of his guests in extension of hospitality. Another thing, he's going to believe the message. They're going to say, we're going to destroy the city. And he's going to believe, he's familiar with the Lord, he's going to believe the message. Some of the people he talks to are not going to believe the message. And he's going to obey. He's going to, although they've got to force him out of the city, he is going to leave the city. So there's several, again, it's not much to brag about, but sometimes in our own lives there's not much to brag about. It's kind of like, well, I believe in the Lord. Well, okay, that's a good start. But again, he's considered righteous because he's not a man from Sodom in the sense that he doesn't think like them. He wants them to come. Now watch the angels though. They says, please come stay at my house, Lot says. They reply, no, they answered. In fact, in the Hebrew, it's like, no, indeed not. No, we're not going to do this. We're not coming to your house. No, they answered, we will spend the night in the square. And that is not a polite statement. Oh, no, we'll be fine. We'll just sleep out here in the streets. No, that is a no, we will stay in the streets. No, that was a rejection. No, I don't want to be in your house. I don't want to live in your under your protection. You can't do anything for us. We'll be better in the streets. and there was not a strategy there. Well, we better stay in the streets and kind of see how things are how to make bring judgment. They are simply rejecting. Clearly, they're rejecting. No. When Abraham says, please, let me serve you, they say, certainly. When Lot says, let me serve you, they say, no. But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. Now, Abraham has talked to God. We just read that. Talked to God, brought him down from 50 to 10 as far as how many righteous people in the city. God's listening to him, making different, responding to him. Here the angels say no. But he said, no, really, come. And he was so persistent that they said, all right, we'll come. We're going to see again another time by the end of the story. They're going to tell him to do one thing. He's going to beg to do another. They say, okay, go do that thing. Again, we see within this chapter 18 and 19, God is sovereign. The angels have all the power they need to bring destruction. But God has designed it, and he has planned it, and it works with this whole thing, that you have input. We call it prayer. If you don't believe you've got input, you're probably not praying. If you believe you have input, if you believe that you have influence, if you believe that God is attentive to your prayers, even in this case, insisting on something. Jesus says, he told the story, a great story, of the unjust judge and the widow who needed help. And the widow kept coming and said, I need help. He said, no, I'm not going to call. She emailed, she phone called, she left text messages. He wouldn't respond. Until finally, day after day, she kept coming and coming to bother him, to ask him questions, ask for help. Finally, the judge said, fine, well, what does she want? Bring her in and let me give her what she wants. Otherwise, she's going to wear me out because she's always on my answering machine. She's always leaving me messages. And Jesus says, the point of that was you should pray and never give up. Not that God is an unjust God, not that you're bothering God and leaving too many messages for him, but the point was if a widow in Israel can have that much influence on a judge, just by bothering him, that he'll give her what she wants so she'll go away, what do you think God is like who desires you to ask him for things? He desires to be part of your life, and he is a just judge. If the unjust judge in Israel will respond to a powerless widow, what will God do for you if you will be persistent? And Jesus' impression was there, an indication was, knock and you will receive, seek and you'll find, ask and the door, how'd they go? Knock and the door will be open. Seek and you'll find. Ask and it will be given. Is that correct? That's not in the right order. But you understand the idea there. It's in Matthew chapter 7, verse 7. I do know what I'm talking about. Okay, here we go. So here they are. Verse chapter 19, verse 3. But he insisted so strongly that he did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast. Now this is not a lavish meal. Bread without yeast is rushed. This is like saying, the fast food story last week, how he said, Abraham says, sit down, and then he went out and he killed a calf and he started kneading bread. It's like, well, how long is this going to take? Definitely not fast food. This right here, unleavened bread, fast food. That is fast food. They didn't let the bread rise. They had no bread. There was the bread they used on the night of the Exodus because they didn't have time to let it rise. They were in a hurry. They rushed out of the country. They're going to be delivered. So it says he prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast. This could be said, this was happening in our houses today. He prepared a meal for them by popping in a frozen pizza in the oven, or popped in one of those TV dinners in the microwave and thawed it out and said, there you go, unleavened bread. And they ate it. Okay? So nothing compared to what they had for lunch at Abraham's place. Before they had gone to bed, okay, tradition, you eat your meal, you go to bed in the safety of your host's house. Now, here it goes. Before they had gone to bed, all the men, from every part, very important, every part of the city of Sodom, and again, young and old. That's very defining right there. All, every part, and young and old. Starting at the bottom, young and old, generational. This was something the fathers had learned from their fathers or the grandfathers, and their sons had learned it from the fathers. This was swept through culture. It was generational. Every part, meaning it was across the culture. It wasn't the rich, it wasn't the poor, it wasn't this section of town. From every part, if it would be in business, if you're going to be in the construction, whatever you're doing, they came. Young and old from every part, and then it says all. They came, they called a lot. Okay, wait, let's go back.
Before they had gone to bed, the angels, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. See? Surrounded. Indication right here, this type of people, this group, moves in a mob. They don't have truth. They don't have reality. They don't have the sanctity of sexuality. They have nothing except mob influence. They can't argue from the base of logic. You've seen, you should have seen somewhere along the line where one man or one woman with truth addresses a large crowd and sways the crowd with truth. It happens throughout history. One person with truth makes the presentation and the multitudes follow because they recognize truth. This group cannot present truth. They can't present reality. They have no argument except lies and deception. And when that doesn't work, because people have logic, they say, that's a lie, that's deception, that doesn't make sense. The only thing they've got left is, guess what? The mob. They surrounded the house. I'm not going to get political right there, but I'm very, very close. Are anybody with me on this? I mean, I could go on another right here. This group can only intimidate, surround, and try and force their political agenda. They have no logic. They have no truth. They are not in reality. They surrounded the house. They called Lot. Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us. I hope you've got your Bibles open. I'm going to stop reading that verse right there. You can read it yourself, can you not? Okay. For the sake of the whole congregation here today, meaning those that don't need to know all this. Bring them out to us so that they can, okay. Verse 6, Lot went outside to meet them. Now, we got this little picture taking place here. There's a door. They're inside the house in the safety of the host, supposedly. Lot, being a good host, goes outside the door. That door is now going to be very important now throughout the rest of this little dialogue right here. That he goes outside. He leaves everybody inside. He goes outside and tries to reason with them. Good luck. You're not going to reason with this multitude. Lot went out to meet them and shut the door behind him, protecting his guests, and said, now notice, no, my friends. When he says my friends, that is an interesting statement. Because what he is doing is he is identifying himself with them. He says, I'm one of you. Lot apparently had some tribe, well, obviously he was sitting in the city gate, but he had identified with them. He's not saying, I agree with you, but he is saying, I'm one of you. I live in your city. I'm one of your judges. I sit in the city gate with you. No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, now again, I want you to read this next part. I'll just read that. I have two daughters. Now right here, what is going on here? You read that next verse, everybody read that next verse? Look, he says, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I've got two daughters. Now, what this is showing us, and this is important, you know this, but you need to be warned of it, and this explains many, many things that come up in our lives or in our culture's life, is Lot has made so many bad decisions up to this point, he is in this predicament. He is living in Sodom and Gomorrah and hasn't left. He is one of the judges of Sodom and Gomorrah, sitting in the gates. He's part of the leadership. He's now surrounded, his house is now surrounded because the angels have come to destroy the city. He's brought them into his house to protect them, trying to be the good host. But just because you're trying right here, trying to make a good decision today, and you've had it happen, but I'm trying to make good decisions. Your good decisions are gone. You've ran out of options. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because he is in this city, he doesn't have a good option to choose from. I've had situations like that in my own life. I've counseled people, if you want to say it that way. I could like to tell you a couple stories. But it's like, you have given me no good option. Choice A is a bad decision. So I'll choose B, which is a worse decision. I only can choose A or B, and they're both bad decisions. Well, let's do the right thing. It's not available. We do not have the right thing left. We've destroyed all of our options. And to realize, especially as a young person growing up, as you begin to live your life and you begin to make decisions, every decision you make, you're eliminating options. You're going a certain direction. There's always hope. There's always God. But eventually, you're going to get into positions because you've shut all these doors. You've eliminated all these options. You only have choice A and choice B, and neither one of them are good. Well, what happened? Well, here he's got right here. His house is surrounded. He wants to protect his guests, but he also wants to protect his daughters. And it's like, what am I going to do? Again, we can't even understand this. Hopefully you don't even understand this. It's like, how can you even think this way? But anyway, I think it comes down to the fact that he doesn't have any good options left. He's surrounded by his house is surrounded by violent men. And he's got to try, to be a man of God, he's got to be the good father, and he's got to be the good host. Well, what do you want to be? You want to be the good father or the good host? And in his case, I want to be the good host. So here's my daughters. Well, that's not a good job. I don't have any options left. I'm running out of options, he's saying. Why? Because you've already made so many bad decisions up to this point. I have two daughters. Okay, I'm not going to read that. Let me bring them out. Okay, you can read that. Da, 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 da. Okay, you're reading this with me? Okay. Verse 9. The men reply, who've come in their wisdom and their negotiation skills. They come and they say, get out of our way. And they replied, and they said, this fellow, speaking of Lot, came here as an alien. Remember, Abraham and Lot were aliens. And now he wants to play the judge. And again, he was. He got elected to some office of some sort. In this case, he's saying now he's trying to negotiate. They're trying to work them through the situation. Don't do this thing. This is not what we should do. We'll treat you worse than them. They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. They got him pinned against the door. And at this point, Lot is out of options. He's trying to be the good host. He's forsaken being the good father. Now his life is in jeopardy. And right, watch this. With him pressed against the door, his house about to be overrun by this mob, the two men said to Lot, do you have anyone else? Excuse me, verse 10. But the men inside, this is the two angels, reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Now who's being the good host? The angels have to protect Lot. Now they pull him back inside the door. Remember, now that he's back inside behind the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, repeats it, with blindness. So they could not find the door. Now again, this blindness, there's probably not a permanent blindness, probably temporary, we don't know for sure. But I'm assuming it was a temporary blindness to relieve the situation. They're blind, they can't find the door. Now they say, okay, they've come to see if the outcry of the city is as bad as they've heard up in heaven. And their decision, what do you think? They didn't have to go they didn't have to even go out and investigate. They pull him back in, they shut the door, and they say to him, the two men said to Lot, do you have anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The evidence has been seen. We've got a mission now, seek and destroy. The outcry to the Lord against its people, the outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. Again, where's the outcry coming from? Victims. Of social victims, whatever kind of victims that come from this uncaring, selfish culture, those that have been oppressed have cried out to God, and now it's over for them. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws, who were pledged to marry his daughters. Those two daughters, apparently, these were their to be married to him. He said, hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city. But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. This may give an indication of how Lot was not respected and how he maybe was trying to bring about some kind of positive influence. Maybe he was in this society. Maybe he was trying to bring about, the righteousness. Maybe. But he'd been rejected and laughed at all along. And here finally he says, it's over. Judgment is coming tonight. You can get out of this. And they, of course, laughed at him, thought he was joking and ridiculed him. Now, let's go on. Verse 15. With the coming of dawn... So it took them all night to get through this episode. Imagine leaving. I mean, there's several, you know, they make a great movie to some extent. But imagine now he's got to get out of his house, get over to his sons-in-law's house, try and tell him to get out of the city and get back without the blind men who are now maybe recovering what's going on. No one's sleeping. It's a crazy night. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, meaning they didn't tell him because he didn't want to go, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished." In other words, maybe Lot spent all night trying to get converts, you know, like Noah's trying to get people on the ark. It's like he didn't get anybody. His two daughters and his wife, which is now mentioned for the first time. You know, we don't know her name. Where's she been? Maybe she came. What's going on, Lot? Maybe she's out somewhere. But anyway, when he hesitated, they're urging him. Now he's hesitating. Why? Why hesitate? The men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. They like children being led out of the city. Lot and his wife and his two daughters, they can't be talked out of the city. They have to be taken by their hands and drug out of the city. Amazing, is it not? And we can make correlations here if we wanted to other things, but let's keep moving. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, one of the angels says, "Flee for your lives." Now the word flee is going to be used five times. They get them out of the city. Now maybe you can figure it out, they're hoping. Now flee, run like a rabbit. Get away from this because we are going to destroy this place. Now again, notice, for the sake of history, for the sake of society as judgment, God does overthrow cities and cultures. It's not the answer every time. Every disaster is not God's judgment, personally or nationally necessarily. But it does happen. If you believe the Bible, of course, if you don't believe the Bible, think the Bible's all passed away, then okay, then it doesn't happen anymore. But if God is still alive, and if God is still controlling history, this type of thing still happens. Okay, let's begin in verse, I'm about done here, verse 70. As soon as they had brought them out, one of the angels said, "Flee for your lives, don't look back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away." But Lot said to them, come on, Lot. I mean, are you getting tired of him? It's like, would you start running, Lot? Just run. But Lot says to them, "No, my lords, please. If your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great mercy and kindness to me in sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me and I'll die." In other words, maybe he's, you know, too weak, maybe he's too old, too out of shape. Maybe he's not going to get away from the disaster before it happens, whatever. He's, "I'm going to die. Look, he says, here's a town near enough to run to, and it is small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared." And the name of the city was Zoar, which means small. It's just a little small town. It's one of the cities that was to be destroyed with this overthrow. It's corrupt like the other cities. He said, look, there's a little city. It's just a little city. It's not that big. It's not going to make that big of an impression on history. Just let me run to that city. Then I don't have to run to the mountains. Just let me go to the city. Now remember, this was one of the cities they were to overthrow. Now what? Again, look at this. He said to them, the angel says, "Very well, I will grant this request too." And amazing, is it not? The angel says, okay, we're to destroy that city, but you want to spare it so you can just run right over there and be safe. We'll take that off the chart. Okay, we're not going to destroy Zoar. "I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it." That is why the town was called Zoar. Again, notice what the angel said. I cannot do anything until you do this thing. I don't want to make too much out of that, but again, you can see the human interaction with the divine plan. Angels are trying to do something, and we've got to get you from point A to point B. It's like the angels are going, would you get to point B so we can do what we're supposed to do? I wonder how that would apply to our lives today. Things are trying to be done, and God is waiting. Would you get over where you're supposed to be? We can't do anything until you get to your right place. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land, so now it's daylight. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife, okay, let's stop right there. So again, what happened right here? It rained down sulfur, burning sulfur, and just, you know, destruction came. It could have just fallen right out of heaven, just like it says. Not a problem with that at all. But when you look at the land right there, it looks like what had taken place was the tar and the pitch and the sulfur was in the soil, was in the land possibly. It's full of salt today, and it actually exploded. It exploded out of the land. The city then sunk, and it rained down what had blown up, came down on top and covered up. And you can see the remains of these things. They're still investigating it today. Whatever takes place, I mean, you can say it doesn't matter. Supernatural just fell out of nowhere. It could go with that. But if you want to look at as many things, God has things prepared. Things are going to happen. And it's what could have happened right there. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, how that happened, did she stop and just look and also got crystallized in the salt? Could be. Or when she turned back, did she stop? I mean, not just they're running and she just like peeked over her shoulder, maybe. Just peeked and bah, got zapped. Or maybe they're going to Zoar and she stops and maybe didn't go any further. Maybe she's like, you know, not moving forward or even moving back and came within the downfall of it, and she herself got covered up in the downfall and became a pillar of salt, which is not surprising because it's the salt sea. There's salt all around. It's dead. I mean, it's just salt. If you saw any pictures we brought back from Israel, like on rocks and different things just in the sea, they're just, it looks like frosting or looks like ice. Everything's covered with salt because it just, as the water evaporates, it just leaves the buildup of salt. So it's not an impossible thing that that's what happened there either. Nonetheless, she turned a pillar of salt, and people have different places where they identify this is Lot's wife here or there. They've got him identified. Verse 20 said, they think they found the cave too where he would have stayed at, but that's another story. Verse 27, early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He goes back to that judgment seat where he is negotiating with God. He looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, towards all the land of the plain, and he saw, now what used to be a place that was like the garden of God. He saw a place towards all the land, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land like the smoke from a furnace. Now, maybe he went out to look because, you know, he knew that God was going to bring judgment, had said something about it, maybe see how his prayers had worked out. Or maybe he heard something during the night or earlier in the day, he'd heard something. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe. So now Lot's been delivered from the kings of the east because of Abraham. He's been delivered from the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah because of Abraham. Just a real quick question for us, or you, me. Are people being delivered because of you? Are you being a blessing to other people because of your righteous life, because of your prayer life, because you're bringing them up before God? Abraham has blessed them twice with his actions and, in a sense, with his prayer. Abraham he remembered Abraham and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. Now, we're done, but I want to look at this. Where did Lot want to go? Want to go to Zoar. But they said, go to the mountains. He said, oh, please, it's too far, I'll die, I can't make it, I want to go to Zoar. It's just a small town, just let me live in Zoar. It's fine, we'll spare the city. Just hurry, get over there. Well, Lot and his daughters move into Zoar. Look in verse 30. Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. You get the point? I mean, he went to the city, but the city itself was so corrupt that even moving in, it's like, and guess where they end up? Mountains. They realize we can't. We escape the destruction of God, but if we stay in Zoar, we're gonna reap the destruction by men. And they ended up in the mountains. It would have been better for them just to go to the mountains, let Zoar get taken off the map, possibly. Hey, I'll pray, and then we'll be done. Father, we do thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for your word. We do ask that our minds and our souls would embrace reality and embrace truth, that we'd be able to make correct judgments based on your word, that we'd not become judgmental, but we would indeed be able to walk in the truth and bring blessing to our society and bring blessing to people that we know. Father, again, we thank you for working in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.